Welcome to ASME TechCast, bringing you the innovators, the innovations, and the issues that push the envelope of engineering. I'm Louise Poirier, Senior Editor at Mechanical Engineering Magazine. Identifying, training, and retaining talent continues to be a challenge for all fields of engineering. At the same time, diversifying the mix of engineering graduates to include more underrepresented groups is critical. To discuss these workforce challenges and some possible solutions, we're joined today by Craig Scott, a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering in the Clarence M. Mitchell Jr. School of Engineering at Morgan State University. He's also the president of the Inclusive Engineering Consortium. But first, special thanks to the sponsor of today's podcast, Missouri S&T. Dive into the limitless possibilities of a career in mechanical engineering with Missouri S&T's 100% online master's degree in mechanical engineering. This program empowers you to design your own graduate program with the flexibility of remote learning, exploring thermoscience, fluid mechanics, energy conversion, composite materials, structures, control systems, engineering mechanics, and manufacturing automation. Visit online.mst.edu to forge your path in mechanical engineering at Missouri S&T. And with that, Craig, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
So to start off with, let's talk about some of the most critical issues that are facing the engineering workforce today. What are you seeing from your standpoint?
I could list many, many issues, but I'll just focus on a few. I think first and foremost, there's the pace of technological advancement. The rapid pace is so quick that a lot of times it's hard for supply to keep up with demand. You know, you have all kinds of things going on, like artificial intelligence, advanced manufacturing, and renewable energy. And keeping the supply, even with demand, it can be challenging, both for educators and anybody in training or credential development. The second area that's near and dear to me is in diversity and inclusion. The engineering field has historically has lacked diversity in underrepresentation of women, minority groups, and geographic location and neurodiversity. And ensuring a diverse, inclusive workforce is vital. It's vital for bringing in a broader range of perspectives and ideas, and this is important. Then we have one, which is the aging workforce. I think, you know, a lot of people are nearing retirement, and it becomes a real challenge to be able to have people come in and fill these positions, because during the course of a person being employed, they develop a lot of unique skills that are hard to transfer. So I think that presents itself from skills gap. And then also there's this appeal factor in the fact that I think in generations, a lot of the appeal of engineering has sort of gone up and down. Even though more recently it's been okay to be a geek, I don't think that people fully grasp the appreciation for what the benefits are that engineering brings to society. Then there's a few more is work-life balance. This is more important. You have to consider what people do in their lives. And so this is something to work along with employers to be able to keep up with today's demand as far as what people's lifestyles are like. And then there's a thing about investment in infrastructure, capacity building, and things like that. It's just really hard to get those dollars in the right place. You can see in politics how long it took us to pass an infrastructure bill. So it's something that has to be done, but a lot of times people are just sort of pointing their finger at each other as to who is to pay for it.
Absolutely. Well, I know this is a topic that so many people are discussing right now, trying to bring in new ideas to build up the workforce. I know you're recently part of an executive roundtable at Stevens that was hosted by the ASME Foundation that was talking about some of these very issues. I wonder if you could share what you found to be the most interesting outcomes of that discussion.
Yeah. It was a great meeting, and it was great to sit around and talk to a lot of great minds in this area. And I found a couple of areas. One was the issue about how to attract and engage the engineering workforce. And I'll just say this, over the years, this issue still remains elusive. And it stems from the comment that I made earlier about the coolness factor, and how do you get people to really buy into and get excited about engineering? The people who are in it, of course, we think it's exciting. From the outside, a lot of times it might take a little more convincing. So if you look at it, how do you recruit people? I think number one, the availability of funds is an issue. But if we were to put that aside, I think that it's the ability for us to market ourselves. And as an engineer, I think it's kind of difficult. It's like walking and chewing gum at the same time. You're supposed to be able to do it, but just for some reason, some people can't do it. I think that in this particular case, we need to really get together with people who know how to market engineering. And you know, we can leave the technical innovation. We can still keep that. But since there are others who know how to do this well, such as those in the entertainment industry, I think we really need to partner with this sector. And that's something that came out in the discussion, and invest in a long-term strategy to tell our story in a more compelling manner. I think the other thing is that in addition to providing resources for capacity building and scholarships, the importance of providing wraparound services, that's something that came out. And that deals with the lifestyle issue that I brought up earlier. Having those for wraparound services, and not only for, in my particular case, I work in academic students, but for faculty and for administration, for other people. In other words, anyone engaged in workforce development, or at least the participants, will need some kind of support beyond just give them money to be there. And so there are things like, you know, people have children, people have transportation issues, all that other kind of stuff. So those things, that was really an interesting conversation during that roundtable meeting.
Yeah, you don't really think about that. Everybody's so focused on bring people in, and there's so many different factors that are keeping them away, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because when I spend a good year, over a year, in dealing with workforce development and looking at programs and how to structure them, and, you know, even though I saw at the top of the list, every time they talk about a program, they said, oh, let's do fellowships and scholarships and fellowships. That is important. But even more important is okay, so now you give people money to be able to do things. Maybe that's not enough.
Absolutely. Well, now I understand that you're president of the Inclusive Engineering Consortium. And so I feel like you guys must be doing some great things there as well. Can you tell me how the IEC is working to address some of these issues as well?
Yeah, well, first, some people may not be familiar with the IEC, and it's a nonprofit organization. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to bringing together academics, industry, and the government to advance education, research, and careers in engineering. And the most interesting thing about the IEC is organized as a super department. It's a super department of diverse faculty, staff, and students, and they're from HBCUs, MSIs, tribal colleges and universities, and R1s or predominantly white institutions. And this consortium is critical, not for just providing it opportunities for underrepresented groups, but also for fostering innovation and creativity in engineering by bringing together a wide range of perspectives. So it's the whole thing about how diversity works. You know, we figured that the sum of the parts kind of argument that, you know, when we get together, we're much more powerful working together, and it does really help. But some of the things that we're doing is we provide workshops, collaborative models, and resources for both students and faculty to use. Some of our signature programs are, we have the 2-4 program that serves to help students transitioning from 2-year colleges to 4-year colleges. And this could be, these are awards up to $10,000 in tuition and stipend support. Then we have the Pathways to Success program that's geared at a 4-year student. And it does the same thing, gives the student support and stipends. So that, and also the critical thing is it offers mentoring and internships. So it's a full package for the student, not just money, but you find guidance and then also opportunities in there. And then the last thing I like to mention, there are a lot of things, is we were the first organization to receive what we call in a NSF Mega REU. REU stands for Research Experiences for Undergraduate Students. So it's a part of that program, but it was awarded to a number of HBCUs and other institutions to be able to get together and have their students have meaningful experiences in research. So you might say, well, everybody doesn't do research, but it's really important to give students an opportunity to work together and to be able to look at the state of the art in terms of what's being developed and how it's being used. So those are some examples of some of the things that we're doing in the IEC.
Well, let's talk about things a little closer to home. So what about at Morgan State? You know, are there any programs or workforce development strategies that you guys are finding successful?
Yeah, there are things that we have done and things that we're planning to do. So I'll speak first about the things that we have done. Maybe I'll preface this by a few things about HBCUs, because I think a lot of times people don't really understand the full impact that they have. And there are a few statistics that I'd like to share with you, if I may. HBCUs are credited with providing 25% of all engineering graduates, or I'll say more generally, STEM graduates, from only 3% of the accredited institutions, especially in engineering. The Information Technology Industry Council points out that HBCUs produce 42% of Black engineers and 47% of Black women engineers. And this underscores their significant contributions in the engineering workforce. NSF did a study where they found out that the HBCUs are 30% of the Black graduates of science and engineering doctorate programs. So that's 30% came from HBCUs. And we do this with the highest rate of production of graduates per dollar. Give you an example. The disparity in funding in FY 2021, Harvard University's endowment alone was $53 billion, which is more than 10 times the value of all HBCU endowments combined. So you look at the graduates we're producing with the resources we have, there's a lot to be said about that. We also provide the opportunity and nurturing environment to many who have traditionally not been able to enter engineering. And so it's very challenging work, but it is rewarding. So now I'll go on to what we do at Morgan. And I'd say this, a little bragging rights here. For many years, and I'll say up till 2021, we graduated the highest number of African-American electrical engineering graduates in the U.S. And with that, they enjoyed a 91% job placement. And there are over 3,900 Morgan Engineering alumni around the world in engineering. So let's start with our secret sauce, okay? And I'm willing to share this. One of the most important things are the freshman bridge programs. We have a couple. One is a resident program, which you find a lot of places have those. And that's where freshmen come in. They stay in a dorm. And then they go over all the things that they need to go over in anticipation of what they would do in their first year. But then that's complemented by an online math program. In other words, we realize that we cannot put everyone in a dorm because it's very costly. So and then sometimes students are doing things where they don't really want to come in and stay in a dorm for the semester. They want to be out during the summertime doing things that students do. So there was an online math program. And you might say online, yuck, but look at the statistics. We had 80% placement in pre-calculus. So 80% of the people who had one or the other of these programs were able to place in the pre-calculus, whereas if they didn't have it, 70% of those placed in developmental math. And a student with developmental math has a 6% chance of graduating in 6 years. At least that's what we found for our students. So that is significant, at least getting into the door. Then we had programs like we had one called Ketchup, which allowed these students, once they came in and they placed in pre-calculus, to be able to get on to a more of a four-year type of schedule by taking courses over the summer. So these things require resources, but they do pay off. Then going further up the line, we have an excellent example of how industry collaborates with universities in sponsoring an accelerated master's degree program, One that we had was the Navy Masters of Engineering and Cyber Engineering, where we teamed up with the Navy. And I believe there are over 30 master's degree students with that. But what it allowed us to do is people complained about the time that it took to produce engineers, especially in graduate school. So we said, okay, let's do it in a year. Let's bring the students on and have them graduate with the master's. So it was pretty intensive. It was modeled after the Bell Labs 1 year on campus program that happened a long time ago. But we applied it, and the Navy loved it. We loved it. And that's something that we hold up as a success story. And this was for cyber engineering, because there's a huge demand in the workforce for cybersecurity. And this was one of our solutions that we found at work for both students and for industry. And then we turned to current efforts. Like now, our Dean Barton, is pursuing and solidifying pathways for our local two-year community colleges. So you can see a thread there that the two-year colleges are important, not only for producing students with associate degrees, but giving them pathways so that they continue on in the four-year institutions. So to leverage that, and then also increasing Capstone support and all offering innovative programs like mechatronics. So looking at what the needs are, trying to match those needs, and really trying to really not keep up with, but get ahead of the curve in terms of doing things that are useful to both industry and to who our students are. And then finally, I say this, I give credit to our president. We're doing what we call cluster hiring. So in other words, we're able to identify strategic areas such as cybersecurity, equitable artificial intelligence, and some semiconductors, form a research group, hire faculty. I believe there's somewhere in the vicinity of 25 to 30 faculty slots that they're hiring to be able to bring these areas to Morgan State University so that we can develop them, have the faculty that can teach and develop research programs to be able to provide for our students. So those are some of the things that we're doing at Morgan State University. And there's a great drive there to be able to reach for the R1 Carnegie classification. However, the challenge is to be able to do that while still maintaining our nurturing environment for students. And that's something that a lot of universities, when they get into that ball game, I'm not going to say it's easy to be R1, but it's quite demanding to be R1, but then do that while keeping the students in mind, such as open door policies and accessibility and things like that.
That's fantastic. That's an amazing amount of work going in.
It is.
Yeah, I think building off of that, you've mentioned so much about HBCUs already. And you mentioned to me that's something that you're passionate about, the roles that HBCUs can play in retaining students and faculty, reducing time to talent. Tell me a little bit more about which you're seeing, what excites you, what worries you?
Yeah, you mean at the HBCUs or just in general?
Let's do both.
Well, I'd say this. What excites me are the statistics that I showed that I discussed earlier with you about all the things that we do. And what really concerns me is the response that we get sometimes. That's why I took time to sort of demystify those things about HBCUs. But there are a number of schools that are, they're having trouble. And the trouble centers around finding the resources to be able to sustain their operations. So the number around 105, 103, a lot of times it hurts me to see that number shrink. So again, I think that if given the opportunity, and if a person is not familiar with an HBCU or an MSI, or especially a travel college or university, that you should take the time out and reach out and see who's there and see what they can do. So to me, the whole thing about supporting us, and also the thing about, as I mentioned before, maintaining that balance. A lot of times people, it's really good, and it's a noble goal to want to pursue a higher research classification. But I think the thing is that it takes a lot of work. And I say this, the whole thing about what we do at HBCUs is that we take the time with the students that people normally wouldn't spend and invest a lot of time on. And we bring them up to the bar. So I think some of the issues about credentialing are really important to us because that levels the playing field. So without, you know, that credentialing piece in mind, a lot of people sometimes question, well, you know, I'm not familiar with this university, so I'm not sure I want to hire a student from this place. But I can guarantee you that if you hire a student from an HBCU, you're getting a quality student. And not only that, but there was a Gallup poll that said that students who went to an HBCU, as compared to, I'll just say, other places, in general, were more satisfied and happier with their education, as well as with their grounding as to who they were in their direction and purpose in their career. So I think just trying to dispel a lot of things, because people think that students go to HBCUs for the wrong reasons. They go there because they're proud, and a lot of times their parents tell them, I want you to go to an HBCU.
Well, we've talked about so many challenges already. What are some more possible solutions that you see to fixing all these workforce issues? I mean, I know there's so many floating out there, but...
Yeah, that's where it really comes down, because I'll say this, and again, you probably picked up most of this conversation has been focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. But I think it really takes a buy-in and bold visionary leadership to be able to make this happen better. I think there are a lot of signals out there as to whether or not this is important or not. I think the right signals are, yes, this is important. Because if you look at perception as an issue, there's a study by McKinsey and Company. They have a whole website that says that if you take diversity as far as gender, a company is 25% more likely to achieve above average profitability if they do that for gender. And then if they do that for ethnic and cultural, it even jumps up to 36%. So this is studies, this is real science that says that, no, this isn't just something nice to do and make people happy and everything else. It's something that makes strategic economic sense for any entity that's out there in business. So I think the leadership is a key issue to be able to do that. And then I think also when you have programs and things that you're developing, I think it's important to embed diversity, equity, and inclusion from the onset. A lot of times this is treated sort of like as a band-aid. It's like, okay, we have this great program. However, you know, we have to have this DEI element. So let's do it and put on it. No, check boxes. No, don't do that. Put it in during the beginning. Because why? Because a lot of times when you design programs, you design their assessment and you look at their metrics. So there you can identify the things that you think that are going to make them successful. And you can build them in from the beginning and have those at the table. Because I'll say this, a lot of times when you're dealing with different sectors, whether it be the neurodiverse or whatever, it makes people feel good when they're in on the initial planning stage and not just an afterthought. So have people at the table when you start to make these things, and then have those difficult conversations, and not only have them, but take action. Because I've seen a lot of times where people get together and the conversations are difficult about why there is bias and things like that. But then the most important thing is not to walk away saying, oh gosh, we have so many problems. But even if it's a little piece, take some kind of action and then follow through and make it happen. But besides those things, again, I had mentioned to reach out and listen to HBCUs and MSI and TCU advocates about in this, and listen to me carefully, about how you can help, okay? Not just come to the institutions and want to cherry pick and get the best students over, you know, 3.x or whatever. But it's like, how can I help? And a lot of times we will definitely sit up on the edge of our seats And you'll find yourself in a position where you get more attention because a lot of people are saying, I can't, whatever, you know, if you want attention, you want us to respond. We respond very well to that question. How can someone help? And then I talked about credentialing. The frameworks are important to be able to level the playing field. And then again, the final note is, if you're in a position to do so, provide those wraparound services that I talked about at all levels. And not only just don't think about the students, but think about all the entities that are in that organization that need to function because they do need help. I brought up the thing about the disparity between Harvard University, their endowments. So, but funding has to come from somewhere. And so if you're in a position to do so, think about those things, about you know, the types of support that people need and help out a lot.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights. It's been a great conversation. Thank you for joining us today.
Okay, well, thank you, Louise, for having me here, and it's been my pleasure.
I'd like to once again thank our sponsor, Missouri S&T. Be sure to visit online.mst.edu to learn more about their graduate programs. And if you'd like to hear more conversations on a wide range of engineering topics, please subscribe to ASME TechCast on your podcast platform of choice. I'm Louise Poirier. Thanks so much for listening.